I hope you have been praying for the pastor, the pastors, as they have been away at this conference. I know that many of you are doing so. Several of you came up to me after the service this morning and said that it sure will be good to have the pastor back. No, nobody actually said that. You're much too gracious for that. I appreciate your bearing with the pinch hitter for these two services. Numbers chapter 16 this evening. Numbers chapter 16. The story of Israel is the story of slow learners. Rebellion and resistance and recalcitrance. God's grace, the powerful intervention, intercession by a few faithful people, and the withholding of judgment, and sometimes not withholding judgment. Rebellion after rebellion after rebellion, and sometimes you just wonder, how stupid can one people be? Now, if you find yourself in that smug group this evening as we begin this story of Korah's rebellion, hold that thought, because it's going to come back to bite you. Ever since God provided Egypt as a haven for His people in a time of famine, and as a circle of protection, a circle of military protection for them as they grew to more than 2 million strong. If God had given them the land of Canaan when they were there, they wouldn't have been able to defend it. And God takes them, of all places, into slavery, into a place where they will be protected so that they can prosper. And only when their numbers are great enough to form an army that will rout the Canaanites does God say, okay, it's time to move. Even in slavery, God is a God of grace. Well, He leads them out to the Red Sea, and they gather on the shores of the Red Sea, and they see Pharaoh's army coming after them, and they say, we never should have left. And Moses holds his rod, his staff, over the sea, and it parts. And you know it happened because you've seen it in the movies. And they march through on dry ground. 3 days later, they come to Marah, and there is no water there, and they start to complain. You've brought us out in the wilderness to kill us. These are people who just walked through the Red Sea. Not long after that, they come to Rephidim, and again, there's no water. And Moses is so frustrated by this time that he commits the sin that will keep him out of the Promised Land, and he's just getting started. And he strikes the rock, and water comes out. Even man's sin is not powerful enough to stop the gracious purposes of God. And then they come to Sinai, and Moses goes up in the mountain, and it quakes, and it thunders, and it lightens. Is that the verb? There's lightning up there. And fire proceeds from the mountain, and down at the foot of the mountain, they make a golden calf and worship it. And Aaron, their priest, says, this is Elohim who has brought you out of Egypt. And you think, how stupid can one people be? That is Elohim! Look at this thing! And then they receive the instructions from the mountain, how to build the tabernacle, how to perform the sacrifices, how to set up the priesthood. And the regulations are very clear. And God says, you transgress these things and it'll kill you. And Nadab and Abihu, within days, offer strange fire before the Lord, and they are struck down in Leviticus chapter 10. Finally, in Numbers chapter 10, they leave Sinai. They are at Sinai for half of Exodus and all of Leviticus and half of Numbers. And by chapter 11, they're complaining again. And they want the food of Egypt. And God says, you're tired of manna that I provide for you by grace every day? Angels' food? You're tired of that? well, I'll give you food. And he gives them quail until they're sick of it. And the name of that place is called Kibroth Hattaavah. In chapter 12, Aaron and Miriam say, Moses, we think you're taking a little too much authority. And they learn a painful lesson. In 13 and 14, the spies go into Canaan and they come back and say, there's no way in the world we can take these people. They're huge. I know that feeling. I went to high school in the town of Lexington, Massachusetts, a suburb of Boston. A little Christian school there. And in one of my headmaster's greatest achievements as far as his life was concerned, the Boston Celtics practiced in our gym for 1 year, the last year that I was there in school. And about the time that we were walking out of the men's locker room after soccer practice, in would come John Havlicek and Henry Finkel. Nobody remembers Henry Finkel, but he was 7'4". I remember Henry. That was a year after Bill Russell retired. I never had the opportunity to share a locker room with Bill Russell. I remember walking out of the locker room one day, and Finkel was coming in. And I saw this navel go by my eyes. I doubt that he remembers me. I know how the spies felt. But the Red Sea, but Sinai, but the water from the rock. How stupid can one people be? And then God says, okay, everybody who was an adult that made this decision that you can't take the land, every one of you is going to die in the wilderness. And that's why they spent 40 years, not because Moses wouldn't ask directions, being a man, you know. And they say, okay, we're sorry, we didn't mean it. And they say, we'll go in, and they die before the Amalekites. Stupid. And now we come to chapter 16. I'd love to read the whole chapter, but our time is limited. So I'll read only as much as is necessary to make the points as we go along. Reading in verse 1, now Korah, the son of Izhar, the son of Kohath, the son of Levi, and Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab and On, the son of Peleth, sons of Reuben. I practiced for days to be able to read that verse. These men took men, and they rose up before Moses with certain of the children of Israel, 250 princes of the assembly, famous in the congregation, men of renown. And they gathered themselves together against Moses and against Aaron and said unto them, ye take too much upon you. In modern English, we would say, you have crossed a line. You have gone too far. Ye take too much upon you, seeing all the congregation are holy, every one of them. And the Lord is among them. Wherefore then, lift ye up yourselves above the congregation of the Lord. Now this is after Aaron and Miriam had supposedly learned their lesson. They're not part of this rebellion. And we're introduced here to the rebels. The rebels are, we're told, Korah. Korah is a son of Levi, a descendant of Levi. The Levites, of course, are the special tribe of Israel that is responsible to care for the temple ceremonies. Levi has three sons, Gershon and Kohath and Merari. The Gershonites cared for the fabrics, particularly during the travels, when they moved the tabernacle. The Gershonites carried the curtains and the hangings and the badgers' skins dyed red and all that good stuff. The Merarites cared for the hardware, that is, the sockets and the pillars and the bars and the hardware on which the hangings hung. The Kohathites were responsible for the furniture. They were the ones who slipped the rods into the rings and carried the ark and the altar and the candlestick and the table of showbread and the other pieces of furniture in the tabernacle. A very privileged group. And it was from the Kohathites that Korah was descended. It wasn't enough to carry the ark. Remember, later, Korah couldn't have known this at the time, but later, David got some well-meaning men to carry the ark on a cart to bring it back to Jerusalem. And one of them, with the best of intentions, when the oxen stumbled and he reached out to steady the cart, and touched the ark, and he died on the spot. Well, it's not enough for Korah to carry the ark without dying. Now, among the Kohathites were a certain group of people. Kohath had a son named Amram, and Amram was the father of Moses and Aaron. So Aaron is Kohath's grandson. And the sons of Aaron, God says, will be the priests. They will be the priests. One subset of the sons of Kohath. Korah is from another subset. He is Aaron's first cousin. And he's jealous because his cousin gets to be a priest and all he gets to do is carry the Ark of the Covenant. The name Korah, we don't really know what it means. Some speculate that it comes from the Hebrew verb karach, which means to be bald. That might perhaps explain his bitterness. I don't know. But he's jealous of Aaron. He wants to be priest. And he falls for the same sin that got Lucifer. It's not enough for Lucifer to walk in the courtyards of Jehovah. He wants to sit on the throne. And he reproduces himself here in this rebel. There are some other rebels mentioned in verse 1. Dathan and Abiram. These are not Levites. They are sons of Reuben. Well, what do we know about Reuben? Reuben is the firstborn. The firstborn of the 12 tribes. And his father, Jacob, Israel, demotes him from that position because he defiled his father's concubine. He did not act in a way that was consistent with his position of privilege and authority. And Jacob said, "You can't handle authority, you're not going to have it." And so Reuben is not the leading tribe anymore. In some senses, Judah is the leading tribe. In some senses, Ephraim and Manasseh are. And in some senses, Levi is. God distributes the leadership among four tribes after the failure of Reuben. And these Reubenites, Dathan and Abiram, are jealous, not of Aaron, but of Moses. They want the leadership. And they gather with them 250 leaders, princes of the assembly, verse 2, famous in the congregation, men of renown. Now listen, respectability does not make rebellion right. I don't care who signs on. It's still wrong. These men should have known better, but they didn't. And that doesn't change the fact that they're still idiots. So these are the rebels. Now we see their rationale. Verse 3. They gathered themselves together against Moses and against Aaron and said, "Ye take too much upon you. Why do you lift up yourselves above the congregation of the Lord?" The charge is, first, that Moses and Aaron have promoted themselves and are unworthy. That's the charge. Now, is the charge correct that Moses and Aaron have promoted themselves? Not at all. God has already made that perfectly clear in earlier rebellions. Is the charge correct that they are unworthy? Absolutely. Absolutely. And one of the great difficulties we face in dealing with authority is that sometimes God places people in authority over us who don't deserve it, who themselves are nincompoops. How many authorities do you have? There are several men in the room here this evening who used to be my boss, so I got to be real careful from here on out. Have you ever had a boss who was an idiot? I have, but none of those guys are in the room. Okay. Some of you have bosses who are idiots. And to make it worse, they're godless idiots. Some of you young people have parents who are idiots. My children have a father who's an idiot. Again, I have to be careful about how I almost said my children do, but that wouldn't be right because only their father is an idiot. I'm careful to say. Some of you are students and you have authorities in your academic life, residence hall leaders, teachers who are idiots. This week was a midterm exam week on campus. I gave a whole bunch of tests this week. I completely screwed up two of the tests, just completely. Got into the middle of them and realized I had done it just entirely wrong. I had to throw out fully one-third of the questions on one of my tests. That engenders confidence in your students, doesn't it? He's an idiot. We've always thought it. Now we have proof. Your authorities don't deserve to be there, with a single outstanding exception. The God who placed them there deserves to be there. So that's their rationale. They bring a second charge down in verse 14. They hold it off for a while. They finally get to it. Moreover, they say, thou hast not brought us into a land that floweth with milk and honey, or given us inheritance of fields and vineyards. He says, you haven't kept your promise. You painted us pie in the sky, milk and honey, living in houses we haven't built, and eating from gardens we haven't planted. And that hasn't happened. Now, what's wrong with this picture? The spies had just come back from a land with a negative report, and the people had believed them. And Caleb and Joshua and Moses and Aaron had said, go in, take the land, it's yours. And they had said, well, we're scared. How stupid can one people be? You haven't brought us into the land? And Moses, because he's not a perfect leader either, verse 15, is very wroth, very angry. That's a weakness he has. And now we see the reaction of Moses and of God to this situation, starting in verse 4. Moses falls on his face, verse 4. That's a sign of mourning. Verse 5, he defers to God. Now, if we had any worries about Moses being very wroth over in verse 15, they are ameliorated here in verse 5 because Moses has the right perspective. And he says, listen, this is not about me. This is about God. And God puts in charge who he wants, and he will support and authorize and verify the leadership he has put in place. And so Moses, and by the way, this is a very different response, isn't it, from striking the rock? Very different. He's learned. He's growing. He's making progress. And so Moses sets up a confrontation between the rebels and the authorized leaders of Israel. And we see that in verses 7 through 11. He says, okay. And this reminds you a little bit of Elijah on Mount Carmel, doesn't it? That's much later, of course. He says, okay, here's what we'll do. You get censers, and you put incense in them, and you light the incense, and you come stand before the tabernacle, before the sanctuary. And we'll see if God accepts your offering. Now, it takes a lot of nerve to do that. Because what if? Well, Moses has plenty of experience at this point and plenty of reason to know that God is going to stand by him. And so he sets up this confrontation. Take censers and appear before the Lord. I think it's interesting that in this passage, Moses takes their own words and throws them right back at them. Look what he says, verse 7. You take too much upon you, you sons of Levi. Does that sound familiar? Yes, verse 3. That was their charge. You take too much upon you. You have promoted yourself. He says, I haven't crossed the line. You have crossed the line. You got to listen to what you're saying. And then he says something that I think is truly remarkable. He says, what is Aaron? Verse 11. What is Aaron? Remember we said that the Levites were correct when they said that these men didn't deserve to be in leadership? Moses admits it. They say, in effect, who is Aaron to promote himself to the priesthood? And Moses says, who is Aaron that you want to rebel against him? This isn't about Aaron. And it's not about Moses. Rebellion against authority is rebellion against God. It's that simple. God raises up kings and puts them down again. And when he puts a king in place, he put the king in place. I often tell this story. In 1992, when Bill Clinton was elected to his first term, I remember going into work at BJU Press the day after the election, and everybody was sitting around looking like God had lost the election. You know, how is the Republic going to survive? It's over. And I remember, I'm a little bit of an imp myself. And I said to a few people, in the hearing of others loud enough so that they could overhear, you know, Bill Clinton is God's man for this hour. And you would have thought I spoke blasphemy. In fact, they were speaking blasphemy. God doesn't lose elections. And when people that we don't like are placed in authority over us, God is still on the throne and we still owe them the obligation of obedience. You want to really put that to the test? Try teaching Bible in China and standing in the front of a lecture hall at a communist university and talking about Chairman Mao as the instrument of God. Now, they don't know all that Mao did. I went to his tomb in Beijing. I went there just to make sure he was really dead. And I was never happier to see anybody dead in my life. They don't know all the people he murdered. They don't know how he destroyed the culture intentionally. Even changed the names of the days of the week to day one, day two, day three, day four. Oh, that's brilliant. And I could stand there under the sponsorship of their state and say, God gave you Mao, and mean it. Now, that doesn't mean life was pleasant. It most certainly was not. But God is still on the throne. And rebellion against authority is rebellion against God. And Moses makes that point right here and right now. Starting in verse 16, you see God's response to this rebellion. They take the challenge. And they say, okay, that sounds like a good idea. How stupid can one people be? Yeah, we'll make censers and put fire in them and appear before Jehovah. That sounds like a great idea. Now, the story gets kind of intertwined from here through about verse 35. You've really got the two groups represented and two kinds of actions and judgments represented. You have Korah, who is aspiring to the priesthood, and you have Dathan and Abiram, who are aspiring not to the priesthood, but to Mosaic position, Mosaic leadership, kingship, if you will. And their two stories are intertwined here in these verses. But it's clear that what happens is, in the first place, with Korah, he is the one and his followers, the 250 princes of the Levites. These men take censers and put incense in them and present fire before the Lord. And in verse 35, fire comes out from the Lord and consumes the 250 men that offered incense. That's God's response to rebellion. With Dathan and Abiram, things are a little different. Verses 20 through 34. Moses tells and Aaron tell the people, get away from the tents of Dathan and Abiram and Korah. Now, Korah and his men, as I interpret the passage, are over at the tabernacle offering incense. But Moses and Aaron say, get away from their houses. Get away from their tents. King James says tabernacles. And verse 25, Moses and the elders confront him and they say, get away from your tents. You are not safe here. And the people who believe, get out. And Dathan and Abiram, verse 27, come out and stand in the door of their tents with their wives and their children. It gets really poignant here. And Moses says, listen, if these men die an ordinary death, then I am not a servant of God. But if a new thing happens in the earth, and the earth opens and swallows them up, then you will know who God has appointed to be king, not king, authority, in this time, in this place. Verse 31, and it came to pass, as he made an end of speaking all these words, that the ground clave asunder that was under them. Earthquake! Well, are you saying it wasn't a miracle? Well, earthquakes are not miracles, but and if this was an ordinary earthquake, then that part of it wasn't a miracle. But the timing and the location were really interesting. And the earth opened her mouth and swallowed them up, and their houses, their tents, and all the men that appertained unto Korah, those that weren't over at the tabernacle offering incense, and all their goods. They and all that belonged to them went down alive into the pit, Sheol, sometimes translated hell. But here I think simply meaning a pit in the ground. And the earth closed upon them, and they perished from the congregation. And all Israel that were round about them fled at the cry of them, for they said, lest the earth swallow us up also. And then the fire comes from God and consumes those who are illegitimately burning incense over at the tabernacle. Now, the response demonstrates to us that rebellion is a serious matter. This is not a simple misunderstanding about the organizational chart. And God ratifies Moses' words that rebellion against authority is not rebellion against authority. It's rebellion against God. Starting in verse 36, we find the remembrance. God says, look, you people have a way of forgetting what you studied between the last class period and today. So I'm gonna help you remember. And the Lord speaks unto Moses, verse 36. And he says, take up the censers out of the burning, the ones that the sinners, the rebels had been holding. And he says, take these things and beat them with hammers and make plates for covering the altar. Because they were before the Lord, verse 38, they are holy. Isn't that interesting? Even though they had been brought out of rebellion and sinfulness, the fact that they had been in the presence of God gave them special meaning. And God says, these are not ordinary pieces of metal anymore. These are special, and you're going to remember them. And so they beat the things into plates, metal plates, and they placed those on the altar so that from this day on, there will be protection from the fire. And the altar won't be burned because the metal protects the altar. And God takes the very thing that had brought His fiery judgment down on the rebels, and He says, now I'm going to turn it into protection. Just as God takes the very thing, the very water that He had used to destroy all life upon the earth in Noah's time, and He turns water droplets into a rainbow as a reminder that water is not going to destroy them again. So it's done. Eleazar the priest makes plates to cover the altar, verse 39. As a memorial, so that the children of Israel will remember this lesson. It's a permanent reminder, and it protects the altar from fire from this day forward. Now, you'd think that the story would end there. And you are just astonished when you read in verse 41. But the next day, on the morrow, says the King James, all the congregation of the children of Israel murmured against Moses and Aaron, saying, ye have killed the people of the Lord. How stupid can one people be? You've got to wonder. Any of you interested in news stories about stupid criminals? You know, the two guys in the pickup truck who wrapped a chain around their rear bumper and around an ATM and tried to steal the ATM, pull it off its foundation with the truck. And they gun the truck, and the ATM is anchored down. And they pull the bumper off their truck, and they panic and drive away, leaving the bumper and the license plate and the chain. The guy who walks into the convenience store with a ski mask rolled up around his head, pulls a gun, tries to rob the place, and halfway through goes, "Oh!" Pulls the ski mask down. Oops. Some of you know that I have a bit of a criminal record myself. I spent one evening under the care of the local constabulary in Asheville, North Carolina. I was a graduate assistant at the time at Bob Jones. I am, as far as I know, the only person in the history of Bob Jones University, the only faculty member to have spent time incarcerated while teaching, while a member of the teaching faculty, and still be on the faculty. I was on extension. Now, that expression among people from Bob Jones is you go out and you conduct ministry and community service around the area, and hundreds and thousands of our students and faculty and staff are out throughout the community and the regions around doing good things, working in nursing homes, in jails, from the other side typically, preaching and holding children's clubs and just really contributing to the community. And I was on extension with the judo team that I was a member of many years ago. And we were late arriving at a meeting in Maggie Valley, and I was driving, and I realized we were late, and so I was speeding. That's the long and short of it, mostly the short of it. And I was speeding, and an officer pulled me over. It was 71 and a 55, and he said, "That's going to cost you $36, and we were all wearing our judo gis, which have a remarkable absence of pockets. And we managed to scrape up $32 amongst us, but that was $4 short. And he said, "Well, unless you can come up with four more dollars, I'm going to have to hold you until your friends can go get the $4. And so he took us down to the Buncombe County Prison and turned me over to the magistrate there. And my friends went on and held the meeting. And our own Lieutenant Colonel Bobby Davis was with us on that occasion. He tried desperately to get me out of jail with his Marine Corps officer's identification. That didn't work. And so I was placed in what peace officers will recognize as the drunk tank there in the Buncombe County Prison until my friends could go hold the meeting. Bobby preached in my place, and then they took an offering to get the originally scheduled preacher out of the pokey on the way back. And while I was in there with all of the inebriates, the Otises of Asheville, who had been placed in there to sober up, and I was sitting there in my three-piece suit, feeling a little conspicuous, and I got in a very cordial conversation with a fellow cellmate. You know, "What are you in for? What are you in for?" You know, you kind of exchange notes, and you learn things. Escape techniques and that sort of thing. And we were in a fairly intense discussion about, he had been running some moonshine down from Tennessee, and he was astonished at how little I had done, given where I was. And of course, everybody lies in jail, so I assume he thought that I was just making up stories and that I'd really killed somebody with a chainsaw or something. We were engaged in this conversation, and then they had taken my Bible away. Apparently, they'd heard that it was a sword. And I wasn't allowed to have it in there. But I was thinking, you know, maybe I'll be able to witness to some of these guys. Well, two problems with that. One, most of them are drunk. And two, you're in too. And that kind of shoots your credibility in the head. But anyway, we were talking along. And all of a sudden, without our realizing it, we didn't notice what was going on. There was a man who was had been passed out on the floor over here against the back wall of the cell. There's a little window here, and then out there is the desk where the officers look in and laugh at the idiots in the drunk tank. And this guy had been passed out the whole time I was in there. And without our, I was turned this way talking to this guy, and without our realizing it, this fella came awake and he stumbled to his feet. And in the disorientation of the moment, he saw that window over there. And he said, I'm going to jump through that window and escape. Well, that's bulletproof glass. It'll stop a 45 slug. And he got as much momentum as he could across that little room. And he hit that window with his head. And, of course, it'll stop a 45. His head is not a 45 slug. And he immediately resumed his original position on the floor. And you know, if you hang around with criminals long enough, you realize that these were not, generally, the brightest guys on the block. Now, I don't really know if he was unintelligent or not. His mind was deeply blurred by his intoxication, of course. But, you know, we love stories of stupid criminals. But at this point, verse 41, you got to wonder, what is wrong with these people? This can't be literally true. They've just seen the fire come down from heaven and destroy 250, and as I read the passage, 251 men with illegitimate censers in their hands. They've seen the earth open up and swallow up Dathan and Abiram and his offspring and their tents and their possessions. And then they say to Moses, you killed God's people. You see how stupid rebellion makes you? Now, several times tonight I've used the term stupid. And I understand that some of you find that offensive. First of all, I have preached in Mexico. And I know that in the Mexican culture, you do not, under any circumstances, use the Spanish word for stupid. You do not use it. It is highly offensive. I also know that many of you in your families don't allow your children to use that language. I know that, and I use the word anyway. I know I'm taking a risk, but I'm doing it for a reason, and I want to make this point. I am not criticizing the IQ of these people. The Bible is very clear that whatever intelligence you have, God gave you. And if you're brilliant, God has a place for you where you should serve humbly. And if you are not brilliant, God has a place for you where you should serve humbly and proudly. In the sense that you're serving Him humbly and proudly. Isn't that interesting? I'm not talking about intelligence, IQ. But I do say this. The Bible makes it very clear that sin, and particularly rebellion, makes you stupid. I'm not talking about your natural thinking abilities. I'm talking about the stuff you do when sin is driving you. And you look at the world around you and the behavior they manifest, and you go, that is just stupid. What is fun? Fun is going to a party, getting drunk out of your mind, and spending all night with your face in the toilet. That is my idea of a good time. And they look at you and say, come on, don't you want to have any fun? And I say, look at yourself. You call that fun? My dog drinks out of that. Oh, well, you can throw off divine restraints and do what you want and love the one you're with. And now we have AIDS. Rebellion, sin of any kind, but particularly rebellion, makes you stupid. You do things that you look back on later and say, what was I thinking? And so the rebellion breaks out again. And in verse 47, plague breaks out among the people. And in verse 47, Aaron, following Moses' instructions, lights a censer and puts on incense and runs into the middle of the crowd. Verse 48, and he stood between the dead and the living, and the plague was stayed. Now that took guts, pardon me. Because a plague by nature is... What's the medical word? I just slipped my mind. communicable, right? Infectious. You catch it from other people. And Aaron goes into the middle of that mob with a censer and stands between the living and the dead. That's called heroism. Any of you recognize the name of Tim McCarthy? Hold up your hand if you recognize the name. You remember him. You just don't remember his name. 1981, March of 1981, Ronald Reagan had just recently been inaugurated president. He was leaving a speech at the Washington Hilton, getting into his limousine outside, and John Hinckley, in an attempt to impress a movie star, took a shot at the president, took several shots. And you've all seen videotape of that moment. Reagan is walking toward the car, and he's raising his arm, and he's waving back in this direction. He's waving at the very man who's about to shoot him. He's waving in that same direction. And you hear one shot, and the Secret Service springs into action as they are trained to do. And you see several men move off the screen to that side, and they're going after Hinckley. They've identified him. They've located him in a split second, and they're going to take him out. And he's got a gun, and they're going to take him out of business. And the agent closest to Reagan does what Secret Service refers to as covering the body. He grabs Reagan and throws him into the car and jumps in on top of him, slams the door, and the car is gone. They don't realize that Reagan has been hit. Reagan thinks that the agent hurt him. He says, "You broke my rib. You hurt me." And it's only on the way back to the White House that Reagan begins to cough up blood. And the agent in charge says, "Change course. We're going to the hospital." And it was a very wise move because Reagan collapsed on the way into the hospital. Well, back to the scene. You see the video of that moment. And everybody's hitting the ground. Brady, of course, by this time, has been shot in the forehead, and he's on the ground. He's the president's press secretary. Mike Deaver is there. He hears the shots. He goes right down to the ground. He's not hit, but he gets down. He knows what he's doing. And people everywhere are hitting the sidewalk, except for one guy. Remember him? His name is Tim McCarthy. He's a Secret Service agent. And in one of the most spectacular moments ever recorded on film, or video, McCarthy is standing there between Reagan and the spot where Reagan had just, well, it all happened so fast, right? Between Reagan and the shooter. And he's looking, and he locates Hinckley, and he sees him, and he takes a very deliberate step to the left and puts himself between Hinckley and Reagan while Reagan is going into the car. And he takes a bullet right in the stomach. And within seconds, he's on the ground too. He's the last one to go down. Now, we have all forgotten his name, but we'll never forget that picture. He knew exactly what he was doing. He wasn't in the wrong place at the wrong time. He was, in fact, in the wrong place for a split second and then stepped into the right place and took the bullet. Standing between the dead and the living, putting himself at risk to deliver those who are in a position to be delivered. That's the rescue. And the chapter ends, verse 50, the end of the verse, with a simple statement: the plague was stayed. Now, rebellion isn't over in Israel. But the lesson has clearly been taught. Now, I could stop right here and talk about how serious rebellion is. But I think I've already made that point. I want to tell you, as Paul Harvey would say, the rest of the story. Turn to Numbers 26. This will take just a couple of minutes. Numbers 26, verse 11. This is the second census that God orders Israel to take after the wilderness wanderings. There had been one before the wilderness wanderings, after the Exodus. And so they're accounting for all the people who are alive now after the first generation has died off. And in verse 11, there's the little simple statement: notwithstanding, the children of Korah died not. And that little statement clarifies what happened back there at the judgment. The people who were swallowed up by the earthquake were Dathan and Abiram and his families, their families. Korah died at the tabernacle. His children did not die. So he had descendants. Who were those descendants? 1 Chronicles chapter 6. As you know, 1 Chronicles begins with a long genealogy. I could tell you a story about why I think genealogies are the most important part of the Bible, but I'm not going to take the time. First Chronicles chapter 6, verse 31. These are they whom David set over the service of song in the house of the Lord after the ark had rest. And they ministered before the dwelling place of the tabernacle of the congregation with singing until Solomon had built the house of the Lord in Jerusalem. And then they waited on their office according to their order. And these are they that waited with their children. Of the sons of the Kohathites, remember them? Heman, a singer, a son of Joel, the son of Shemuel, son of Elkanah, son of Jehoram, son of Eliel, son of Toa, son of Zuth, son of Elkanah, son of Mahath, son of Amasai, son of Elkanah, son of Joel, son of Azariah, son of Zephaniah, son of Tahath, Asir, Ebiasaph, Korah, the son of Izhar, the son of Kohath, the son of Levi. What happened to Korah's descendants? They became Levites, and they served in the temple. Specifically, we read from other passages, as doorkeepers, porters, and as musicians. And by the way, as bakers. They were the ones who made the showbread. Did you see another name in there that looked familiar? Verse 33. The son of Shemuel, the son of Elkanah. Who's that? That's Samuel the prophet. He's a son of Korah. The sons of Korah wrote 11 psalms. A particular son of Korah named Asaph wrote 12 psalms. I'd like to take you to Psalm 75 and see something he wrote. Psalm 75, verses 4 through 7. I said unto the fools, deal not foolishly, and to the wicked, lift not up the horn. Lift not up your horn on high. Speak not with a stiff neck. What's that talking about? Rebellion. Where do you think he got that? For promotion cometh neither from the east, nor from the west, nor from the south. But God is the judge. He putteth down one and setteth up another. You know what happened to the sons of Korah? They learned the lesson. And they served God in spectacular ways. They were the Dr. Cooks of the temple. Wow. Bet you didn't know Dr. Cook had that in his history. As far as I know, he's not physically related to Korah. Cook, Korah, no. I mentioned that this is a psalm of Asaph. I mentioned that the sons of Korah wrote 11 psalms. Some of the most powerful and lyrical passages in all of the psalms are written not by David, but by the sons of Korah. From Psalm 45, Thy throne, O God, is forever and ever. The scepter of Thy kingdom is a right scepter. Thou lovest righteousness and hatest wickedness. Therefore God, Thy God, hath anointed Thee with the oil of gladness above Thy fellows. All Thy garments smell of myrrh and aloes and cassia, out of the ivory palaces whereby they have made Thee glad. Who are they talking about? The writer of the Hebrews tells us they're talking about Christ. From Psalm 46, God is our refuge and strength, the very present help in trouble. Therefore will we not fear, though the earth be removed, and though the mountains be carried into the midst of the sea. Though the waters thereof roar and be troubled, though the mountains shake with the swelling thereof. There is a river, the streams whereof shall make glad the city of God, the holy place of the tabernacles of the Most High. God is in the midst of her, she shall not be moved. God shall help her, and that right early. From Psalm 48, Great is the Lord, and greatly to be praised in the city of our God, in the mountain of His holiness. Beautiful for situation, the joy of the whole earth is Mount Zion, on the sides of the north, the city of the great King. From Psalm 84, How amiable are Thy tabernacles, O Lord of hosts! My soul longeth, yea, even fainteth for the courts of the Lord. My heart and my flesh crieth out for the living God. Yea, the sparrow hath found an house, and the swallow a nest for herself, where she may lay her young. Even Thine altars, O Lord of hosts, my King and my God. From Psalm 87, glorious things are spoken of thee, O city of God. We still sing the hymns of the sons of Korah today. Now, when Warren put together the order of service for this evening, he could not have known when he chose words to begin the service that I would independently choose the same words to end it. The sons of Korah from Psalm 42. As the hart panteth after the water brooks, so panteth my soul after thee, O God. My soul thirsteth for God, for the living God. When shall I come and appear before God? Why art thou cast down, O my soul, and why art thou disquieted within me? Hope thou in God, for I shall yet praise Him who is the health of my countenance and my God. The rebels learned. And because they learned, and because they repented, a gracious God restored them to a place of service and a heritage that continues to this day. Now, we're all rebels. But rebels can repent. Let's pray together. Father, even as we marvel at our own stupidity in the midst of rebellion, we marvel at Your grace in forgiving and in accepting and in empowering and using us in Your service after the depths of our failure. Father, may we go from this place this evening devoted to Your service and prepared to serve You with a full heart and with a pure heart of gratitude because You have forgiven our sin as we have repented. We ask these things in the name of Jesus, who is the payment for our sin. Amen.